I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Brooke Darnell. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations. You won the Fogarty Literary Prize.
I did. I still can't believe it, but I did. Yeah.
So when did you find out that you'd won it?
Basically when they announced it on Wednesday night. So I knew I was shortlisted and, you know, that I was up for it, but I was quite convinced that it wouldn't be me. And so when they said my name, I was very stunned.
Yeah. And who did you have around you?
So I had my husband, luckily. My parents, two of my brothers were there, one of them couldn't make it, and then also my best friend and her husband came, so I had a lot of support there. But also I knew so many people who were at the event, some writers who were launching their books, and just other writers, people who'd been published with Fremantle before, so I really got a good, strong, you know, welcome, and people were really, really pleased for me, which was really lovely. Yeah.
Well, I imagine everyone was jumping out of their skin all around you, and you were sort of the only calm one
yeah.
in the room.
Oh well, we were on stage, so I didn't have anyone next to me to kind of. But actually, Patrick, who was one of the other shortlistees, I got a hug, so that was lovely. But yeah, I think I managed to keep it together somehow. Yeah.
Now, for people who aren't aware of this prize, just tell them a little bit about it, the people who've inaugurated it, and what it's for and what it gives you.
Yeah, so it's the Fogarty Literary Award, sponsored by the Fogarty Foundation. They've only held it once before, so it's biennial, every 2 years. And 2019 it would have been, it was won by Rebecca Higgy, and so now me, so we're the two. So you get, you send in a book length manuscript, a few genres they accept, and the winner gets a publishing contract with Fremantle Press for that manuscript. And then the Fogarty Foundation has also $20,000 prize because of their support for young people, education, emerging writers, the arts and things like that. So it's a prize for under 35-year-old writers at the time of submission.
Well, it's just fantastic. And
it's amazing.
We all take our hats off to the Fogartys for inaugurating this. It's a great thing. And what does it mean to you?
I mean, it means so much to me. Even just getting the publishing contract obviously means so much to be publishing with a place like Fremantle Press, which is so reputable but also local. But to get $20,000 is unheard of. You don't get that kind of money, especially in your first book. Like, it's very, very rare. And so to be able to get that space to work on new writing, to maybe undertake some professional development, things like that, it's just, you know, beyond what you kind of think when you're trying to get your name out there and get your first book published.
Well, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
So you, as it turns out, snuck in just before the magic birthday arrived.
Exactly. I was 1 week away from 35, and I would have been ineligible the day I was 35, but luckily the due date was a week before. So
it make me wonder whether there'll be a requirement to produce your birth certificates in the future.
I promise.
Now, your is it a working title, or is it a title that you necessarily have to maintain? The Glass House.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my understanding would be that that's the intended title. I wouldn't say it's not. It's impossible that the title would change, because things change. But it's certainly better than other titles I had come up with it. So I'm happy with that title. It reflects a lot of the themes going on in the book.
The danger, I imagine, is to workshop a title with your family and friends and the readers of the manuscript and ask them what they think. You probably get as many answers as people you ask.
Exactly. And if you ask them for suggestions, you'd probably get some kind of crazy stuff. So no, I'm happy with The Glass House. It seems to me like a book that you'd look at on the shelf and go, ooh, you know, I'd buy that.
Now, I've been lucky enough to have been given a number of the first pages, which I've read.
Yes.
I won't give too much away.
Yeah.
But you might like just to tell our listeners, in the classic sort of year 10 level at school, précis of the novel.
Yes.
What it's about.
So the novel opens with the main character. Her name's Julia. She's in her mid-30s. She's from Perth. She's currently living in Melbourne with her husband and her stepdaughter. But when the novel opens, she and her brother have decided that Julia's going to go back to Perth and kind of pack up their father, who's in his 90s. He's been living in the big family home and they've decided it's not safe for him anymore. He's really getting too frail and he needs to go into aged care, which at first the father has agreed to. So it's supposed to go smoothly. And Julia's kind of happy to take the time out from her marriage. She's having some, disconnection with her husband.
How old's the stepchild?
The stepchild's 14.
Oh, what a... Yeah. And you said a girl?
A girl, yes.
Oh, what a difficult thing. Where could this idea possibly have come from, Brooke?
Yeah, well, I don't have a stepdaughter, so...
Were you once 14?
I was once 14, and I'm sure it's, that was 21 years ago, so the difficulties I encountered when I was 14 were not so much internet-related, I assume, as they are now. But I think that the way that... girls interact with each other, the way they feel like they should interact with boys when they're 14 is probably quite similar. So, but actually the 14-year-old in my book, she's kind of a dream 14-year-old in the sense she's not a goody two-shoes, but she's very practical, she's pragmatic, she kind of knows more about what's going on than her parents or her stepmother. She's got, really solid outlook on life and stuff, and so even though Julia is really worried about her missing her when she's in Perth, it's you kind of think at first it's Julia with the problem rather than Evie's actually more adult maybe than Julia.
Evie. Now there's a lovely name.
Yes.
So Julia has this parental challenge.
Yes.
Which is a very common and important theme in Australia.
Yeah.
As we sit and talk about these things. She flies here to Perth.
Yep.
And she finds her way to her father's house,
That's right, yeah.
And really, from that point on, things start to blossom.
Yes, that's right. Things, and start to blossom maybe in a way that Julia didn't expect. So
every novel needs a protagonist.
Yes, exactly. And every novel needs a conflict. If it had all gone smoothly, I don't think there would have been much of a
prize-winning novel in it.
No, exactly. So she gets to the house and, like I said, her father has originally agreed to go into aged care. When Julia gets there, her father suddenly has a dog that he's never had before. The origins of the dog are quite mysterious, and then the father starts making some sounds about how he's not going to go into aged care. And, yes, things get quite difficult.
Now, we want people to have their sort of... bated breath.
Yes.
And not to satiate them too quickly about all of this, but what was the process that you went through in conceiving the idea? I always get mixed up with plots and other things when one writes, but are there some themes running here?
Yeah. So there were three kind of main ideas that I think really coalesced into forming the novel. So I'd had for a long time this kind of desire to write a book-length manuscript about a female character who's in her mid-30s. She's trying to decide whether to become a parent of her own, a parent for herself, and then at the same time she's dealing with a parent who's either declining, passed away, something like that, that makes her kind of confront, do I want to be a parent? What was my childhood like? And things like that. So that was one idea I had. And then I had these couple of other ones floating around, which it took me a sadly long time to realise I could combine them. They didn't need to be three separate ideas. But the other two, so one of them had this kind of power play idea where maybe... a woman who can have children and a woman who can't have children. Maybe the woman who can have children, she kind of suggests, oh, well, I could have a child for you. I could be like a gestational carrier, a surrogate. But unlike the 99.9% of women who offer that in reality, who are selfless, the woman in the book idea that I had would be kind of a power thing going on, and like, I can do this for you, you know, wouldn't you love me, all that kind of stuff. And then the final idea that I was toying around with was kind of relationships between girls who are kind of, yeah, going through adolescence, the age Evie is, and then how they might think that if an adult man shows interest in them, that that's not predatory, that it's charming or exciting or something like that. And so those were the three ideas. And when I finally figured out, oh, they could all be one idea and go into the same book. And then that was actually when things started happening, and actually, yeah, it's had a bit of a plot and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Sounds like it could be a television series in three series.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I should have dragged it out a bit longer.
Well, everyone's going to look forward to reading a novel based on your manuscript with those sorts of themes. But let's talk a little bit more about you and your, if you like, urges to become a writer. When did this all start?
Well, I think I was one of those kids who just decided from very young that they just were going to be a writer. And I believe my mum still has a copy of my first
published book. Your first novel?
Yes, of which there is one copy, which had the earth-shattering twist at the end of they woke up and it was all a dream. So that was my skill when I was about six. And then I just always wrote, like I would write in class once we had a home computer, you know, I'd get Windows 95 and open Word and just write stuff that went nowhere. And so it's kind of like, I think I just thought I was a writer and I never decided against it, which was, yeah.
So what were the first, apart from that manifestation at six, what were the first more formal manifestations, or if you like, steps into proving perhaps to yourself that you were a writer?
Probably the thing that comes to mind was there used to be a competition, which I'm pretty sure they don't run anymore, but it was the West Australian Young Writers Competition. It used to be, you know, your story would be published in the West. And when I was in kind of upper high school, I sent a short story into that competition and I was equal first that year. And so, and I remember thinking, oh, I can, you know, write. So, prior to that, everything had just been kind of stories that began and didn't end and things like that. And then I thought, well, I'll do creative writing at uni. And so I did a double degree at Murdoch, which was journalism and creative writing. And then I just kept doing creative writing. I just didn't stop. Yeah.
Didn't stop. Creative writing.
Yes.
It's a genre of its own in a sense, isn't it? It's an academic discipline. Yes, and you've done a PhD in creative writing.
Yeah, yeah.
Has that enabled you to produce this manuscript, or was it something quite separate?
I think, so this probably, you know, is in a strict sense, obviously this manuscript wasn't written as part of my PhD. I did my PhD quite a while ago, but the skills that I learned at the time about, again, actually completing a book-length manuscript without kind of giving up right towards the end or getting distracted by a new idea, because you have these like highs and lows when you're writing something for months. Sometimes you're in love with it and you think you're a genius, and sometimes you think it's the worst thing that's ever happened, and if you publish it, you'd be put in prison for how terrible you are, you know. So, and you have to kind of ride those waves if you've committed to finishing something, and which, you know, was invaluable learning that as part of my PhD. I had to finish what I'd started. And just the skills. So my supervisor when I did my PhD was Brenda Walker at UWA, and she's obviously a fantastic writer herself, and she just taught me so much just by, you know, just crossing things out. And you know, you don't need to say that, and I'd just be like, oh my god, I don't need to say, you know. And so, and then also there were other writers there that I could work with, so talk to them about ideas. I formed friendships I've still got now. So that whole process, yeah, I don't know if I could have years later produced this manuscript that I have, and actually finished it, actually been, you know, hopefully done enough with it that that Fremantle Press liked it. I don't think that probably would have been possible without the PhD and what I learned.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if you were talking to that upper high school girl that you once were, now with what you've learnt along the way in that formal educational setting, plus doing the hard work as a writer and submitting manuscripts, and you won some other prizes, I think, along the way, what would you say to her? Were there any particular tips that would have been useful to her then, or did she just have to sort of suck it up and go through it?
I mean, I probably, the only thing I could say would be that, you're on the right track, this is a good idea kind of thing. But I don't, it's interesting because I'm just imagining myself as a 17-year-old, and if I appeared to myself as a strict realist, I would be like, I wouldn't listen to myself. So
that's what I'm wondering.
I'm just thinking, would it be worth going back in time and telling her anything? Because she'd probably lose her mind, I suppose. But I think just saying, you're on the right track, you will learn a lot from this, even if, if you don't end up publishing the manuscript you wrote as part of your PhD, which I published part of it in a different form, but I'd say this is something that will, put you in good stead for years and years. It's not just about these 4 years of doing the PhD. It'll teach you skills that you'll need.
You mentioned when you first went to university, I think you mentioned Murdoch, you did journalism and creative writing. Is it a good idea for writers to have that other skill? It mightn't be a writing skill, but in that case, journalism would be. Have you worked as a journalist?
Only the work experience I did as part of that degree. I'd say it's interesting because when you're good at English at school, a lot of the at least when I was there, a lot of the suggestions are you're good at English, become a journalist. And so,
why is that? Is it because the teachers can't quite conceive that anyone can actually become a published novelist?
I think so. Yeah, I think maybe a lot of parents would be like, if a teacher said, "Oh, you're good at English. Why don't you try and publish a book?" The parents would be like, "Can you please tell my child to get a job that pays money?"
Exactly.
Much more commonly,
yes.
But I think, and it is obviously, you do need to be really good at English in quite specific ways if you're a print journalist, because you need to be able to be succinct, you need to be able to, your writing needs to be clear, you need to be able to structure all of those things. But if you're kind of I don't know if just being good at English, especially in the sense that I was, which was like, I like making things up and looking out windows and blabbing on and stuff like that, it's not quite the same English skills.
If you can write about a cloud in three or four paragraphs, then better than journalistically saying there was a cloud.
It was
white.
Yeah, that's right. They have different audiences, they have different purposes. Obviously journalism is fantastic and it's very necessary. And I wouldn't say I was bad at it. Maybe my employers would say I was bad, I don't know. No, they seemed quite happy with me, but it wasn't, the things that I liked about English are making things up and pretending something happened, which you can't do in journalism. That's
so
rule number one.
Is this the same as saying you like being a storyteller?
I think so, yeah. But I especially like being a story that I made up storyteller. Personally, if I hear true stories, for my purposes, thinking of them, like my interest in them as a writer, I'm always like, yeah, but what if, and then changing it. So I don't really write memoir, nonfiction, or anything, because just for my taste in writing, I like to go, yeah, but what if I changed it to suit my own purposes? Which again, that's not journalism.
No, it's not. But it probably leaves some basic truths there.
Well, that's my intention. So I'm like, what is the essence of this thing that I read about or heard about or thought about or version of something that happened to me that is kind of would speak to other people, would kind of, make people realise things or appreciate things in a different way. But how can I tilt it in order to make that happen, like in the bounds of telling a story? So... And that's just my approach to it. But that's why I like to make stuff up. I'm like, how can I heighten that thing that I've figured out, you know.
Now, it's often said,
yeah.
and if it isn't, I am about to say it, that people's early novels, their first novels, are often quite autobiographical.
Yes.
Is that inevitable? Do you think that's a universal truth? Is it true in your case?
Well, I guess, I don't know if it's like literally true, especially I guess if someone was writing really, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, and they wrote about a trip to Mars or something, it's probably not true. But I think all novels are kind of autobiographical in the sense of what, you know, how the author, I guess, processes things, how they view the world, what they've been able to kind of take from different experiences they've had. So to a greater or lesser extent, some of them are based on things that happened to them. For my manuscript, you know, if I don't count manuscripts I began and I didn't finish, this is probably my like third or fourth one. So it's, I wouldn't say it's my first manuscript, although it will be my first novel when it's published. But there's definitely bits in the manuscript that have been adapted from my own life, and you know, Julia's in a similar age range to me. The family house she's describing is similar to my own childhood home. It's in a similar area, although not the same. The kind of things that she thinks about when she bumps into this old friend whose friendship turns out to be a bit dodgy. When she remembers things about their childhood friendship, it's a bit based on, I remember like girls' power play when you're like before you're 10 and you're trying to, you know, work out a pecking order and stuff. But that's about as far as it gets. Because I always say, I personally, my life's not interesting enough to make a novel, so I've got to bring in all these other bits that
I. Anyway, life's experiences are all brought to bear on yeah. writing.
Yeah.
Now. A technical thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this would be the same for each of your manuscripts that you've just mentioned. Is there a typical time by which you start thinking, start coming up with ideas, and then drafting, writing, and then concluding something?
I think for me, especially over the past few years, I've had these different, kind of premises for manuscripts that I kind of start, I abandon, I finish a version, I don't like it, I go back to it. So it's probably like, I don't know if it's like a 4-year long cycle or that sounds too long. Maybe it's like a 3-year long cycle or something for me where, and I have to kind of start it in a different form, kind of blitz through a first draft because I'm really enjoying it, reread it, decide it's terrible, leave it. And then 6 months later, when I'm sick of something else, go, hang on, that old idea I had, maybe I'm a genius with that old idea, go back to it.
Don't throw the first draft out.
Oh, never. My computer is, you know, groaning under the weight of unfinished drafts and first drafts.
But that's interesting. You hear about well-established authors, novelists, crime writers, and no doubt they've been successful and they're under pressure and deadlines.
Mm.
Going to the proverbial writing room down the back of the garden and spending 5 or 6 hours each day and getting that first draft out.
Yeah.
It may well be, in many people's cases, the last. Maybe it comes with experience.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you adopt that approach a little bit. You just said you got the first draft and then you come back to it and think, I'm not the genius I thought I was, or perhaps I was.
Yeah.
So is that the approach that one ideally tries to take to get it down?
For me, I mean, because everyone has really different approaches. You hear stories about people who won't move on from a page until the page is the very final version and stuff. I think that's quite odd, but I mean, not odd. I mean, odd as in unusual. You know, whether people, how quickly they finish a first draft, how much they kind of, because sometimes you can say a first draft and it's like literally you haven't read back on anything you did and it's full of mistakes and contradictions and there's gaps and everything, but you kind of feel like I started at the beginning and I got to the end. Or you can be very kind of methodical, you can have a plan, you can not have a plan. So people have all these different approaches. I always think whatever works for you is great, but for me, I kind of have a loose plan in my head. I do quite speed through the first draft when I manage to get to the end, because I have it all in my mind. I want to get it down. I'm really enjoying it. I'm kind of living in that world. And then going back to it, rereading it, deciding, is this worth spending time on revising and stuff, is a slower, more methodical kind of process, I think, yeah.
And was there a point with The Glass House, people, I'm assuming, do live in glass houses, where you just knew you canned it, I've got it?
Oh, that's interesting. I think, I wouldn't say my thought was I've got it, but when I actually thought, oh, I can combine the woman coming home to her parent, the kind of power play surrogacy thing, and the childhood bullying thing together, and they can all speak to each other and kind of bring out, you know, why, oh, that's why this woman behaves the way she does with her father, that's why this woman behaves the way she does with her old friend, that's why she behaved that way. I thought, oh, this has got kind of meat on the bones kind of thing, instead of sometimes I write things and I think the doubts I have about them is that they're a bit thin, there's only kind of one or two things going on. So probably once I started to think I can put these things together and they can all speak to each other, then I thought, oh, this is actually going to be both fun to write and it might actually, you know, have some potential. Yeah.
Now you got to the end.
I did.
Of this. You submitted it in the nick of time.
Yeah.
It's won this wonderful prize and must feel quite chuffed. And people like parents always want their children to succeed at something they dreamed of doing.
Yeah.
And the whole wider family must be so pleased to see all of this. But what do you want people to take away from this book when they read it?
I want people, well, first of all, I want them to kind of finish the last page and have that feeling that you have when you've read a book, that kind of you enjoyed the writing, you could imagine the characters, you could imagine the scenarios, and also something a little bit unexpected happened, that it wasn't just that kind of pro forma, oh, I could predict that from the first page kind of thing. So I guess on the first level, I just want people to think it's a good book. I know that's quite a broad statement to make. But I'd also, in terms of this book specifically, because I have this character, Julia, who she's been trying to have a baby, it's not really working. She doesn't really know how much she wants to push it in terms of, you know, assisted reproductive technologies, adoption, whatever. You know, she's quite happy with her husband. She really loves her stepdaughter. She's not really sure what to do. I'd like people who might be in that situation, or have experience, or who know people in that situation, or even, you know, women who, and men who are younger, who think they might have kids one day, but not sure, is it going to happen for them? Are they really going to want it? How complicated does it feel? I guess specifically I would like people like that to recognise themselves in the novel, and to kind of feel like that situation is realistic, and those stories that, if those things happen, it does bring up a lot of questions about what would you do, how far are you willing to go, how much is your existence really riding on it or not. So
and what's going to be very important in this case is to read to the very last line.
Exactly.
Now, a couple of more general questions. Whether or not they arise in your novel at the moment, I'm fascinated by a sort of a cultural debate that seems to be going on about the extent to which people from different ethnic backgrounds or genders and the like can, in a sense, be accused of appropriating other people's identities. Is that something you have to grapple with, or?
I think definitely if you're a sensitive person and a person who's kind of aware that these issues are important, then I think definitely these days there's kind of no excuse for not thinking about them, considering them. And thinking about the balance between, do I have the right to tell someone else's story, even if it's invented? Do I have the right to take on that voice and that point of view, versus if it's not addressed in any fashion, then it's kind of whitewashing or silencing or pretending that certain issues don't exist. So I always try and And I think in general, if a writer is aware of those issues and doesn't want to take things away from people who've genuinely experienced them and never get the chance to talk about it, but also doesn't want to pretend those things don't happen, they will hopefully in general find their way to somewhere where they can feel more comfortable. But I think if we're uncomfortable or if we're questioning stuff, that's always good because it means you're not just assuming that, oh, everyone has my exact, you know, gender, class, sexuality background, and I don't even need to consider that other people exist, because that's not true.
Leaving aside things like gender fluidity, is it easy for a woman to project a male voice, and do you think vice versa?
I don't know if it's easy. I always think with stuff like that is that if you're coming up with a character, you're trying to come up with an individual. So as a woman, for example, if my speaking or point of view character was a man, he wouldn't just be a man. He'd have a name, he'd have interests, he'd have a background, a family and stuff, and that would make him unique. So I wouldn't, in a sense, be speaking for all men. I'd just be more or less successful at imagining what it's like to be this particular man. I think also that it's when you are the person whose identity isn't the privileged one, it's less risky, because if I write a book that, for example, said, oh, this is what men think, and I'm wrong, which I, you know, if I took that point of view, I probably would be wrong, because men don't think anything, it's individual men and stuff. But if you make mistakes and if you're stereotypical and stuff, it's less damaging, because those people have the privilege, so it just doesn't... I'm not saying it's good, but I'm just saying it doesn't hurt people as much as if you misinterpret an identity that has far less power. Yeah.
A related topic is really an age-old one as well. Are some books sort of naturally intended for, likely to appeal to men versus women?
Yeah. I think the kind of... I don't know how accepted it is these days. It might be out of date. But I remember hearing that, you know, for example, one of the reasons why J.K. Rowling took that as her publishing name, or her original one. I know she publishes under different pseudonyms now. But instead of, you know, Harry Potter by Joanne Rowling, it was Harry Potter by J.K. Rowling, because the idea was that, in this case, boys, children, will read books written by men, but they don't really like the books written by women, whereas supposedly girl children didn't care. So for her to appeal to boys and girls as readers, she would make her name not clearly a female name. I don't know, you know, was that true then? Is it true now? I'm not really probably, I guess, across that stuff. But I think also you've got to have that balance in your mind. Obviously, you're writing for readers. Otherwise, you'd write your stuff in a journal and put it under your bed. But you're never going to please everyone. You're never going to appeal to every single reader. So, you know, the extent to which you try and broaden things or narrow things, I guess you've got to think about what's the effect that going to be on diluting, you know, what you're writing, I guess.
And Brooke, again, not unrelated to that, but no doubt it's personal and perhaps it's part of technique and that's individual. Do you lock yourself away in a cavern of your own and not share what you're doing with anyone and trust your own instincts and think to yourself, this is my work and I don't want anyone else influencing it? Mm. Or do you share it perhaps with other writers? Yeah. Are you in some group? You mentioned you're married. Do you show your husband, etc.?
My husband, it's he's not a big fiction reader, which is fine with me because if
you might have to read it out loud. To
yeah, he can read it. Just, yeah, I'm sure he'll read it when it's published. But that kind of works for me because the idea of watching him read it and trying to decipher his facial expressions would probably fill me with more anxiety than I can cope with. There's a couple of fellow writers who I would share things with. Probably not first drafts. Probably if I got to a certain level of drafting where I was like, I'm confident that anything that I know is wrong is gone, and all I can do now is ask someone else for their opinion. Because if you ask someone for their opinion a bit early and they point out all this stuff you already knew, it's not as helpful. In terms of this manuscript, which is going to be published, The Glass House, I didn't actually end up, ideally I would have done that as part of the process, but I didn't end up having the time to kind of give it to someone, give them that amount of time to read.
In that sense, it hasn't been through an editing process or?
No, so, or even just a feedback process. Yeah, it would be more like, am I missing anything, you know, because you can never see anything 100%. There's always blocks in your vision as the writer that you don't realise that a reader would pick up on. I think hopefully the things like doing my PhD, all the short stories I've written, the teaching I've done, competition judging I've done, books I've read, you know, all my experience, hopefully I can kind of think myself into the minds of people. Like I felt like by the time I'd finished my PhD, Brenda, like I said, she used to cross things out, and I felt like she crossed out less because as I was writing, I'd go, oh, Brenda would cross that out, and I'd cross it out for myself. So hopefully I'd been able to, like I said, you can never 100% do it, but I could think as I was writing, what would, you know, this person say? What would a reader think of that as much as possible? Yeah.
Brooke, we're getting very close to the end of our discussion.
Yeah.
This manuscript now has the life of being edited from a press and turned into a book and being given a cover and coming out into the world following all of this gestation. That'll be a very exciting moment.
It will be, yeah.
But in the meantime, tell me, I imagine the answer is yes, do you have another book or two on the go?
Not on the go as in I've actually started them, but definitely percolating in the back of my mind, what will I do next. I always feel better when I've at least got an idea that I'm latching onto and thinking about and considering how could this go. But again, it's an idea that I probably had originally like 3 years ago, wrote a version of it, you know, no good. And now I'm like, oh, what if I actually, so yeah, changing it a little bit and maybe it'll have more potential, I think.
Well, we will all look forward to the second. Before too long after the first.
Yes, hopefully.
Well, once again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
On the Fogarty Literary Prize. Good luck with all of your writing.
Yeah.
You'll no doubt over the next little while become a media personality and books to launch and everything that comes with it. But congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Significant moment.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great conversation.
Bye for now.